On this episode of Skeptico.
I am a hat. You are a shoe. I belong on the head. You belong on the foot. Yes? So it is.
You want to tell us a little bit about what's going on in that scene?
The movie definitely takes a very powerful Gnostic take, because those in the back of the train are those that are oppressed, and you could say those, they're the ones that are in Plato's cave. I come from more of a philosophical Gnostic view. And at the end of the day, I know that all religion is basically art. It's a form of art. And the best gift we can as human beings, regardless of the situation or the science or anything else, is to create better than the creator gods, to create better than those that suppress us.
I love that Gnostic kind of twist that you always add in, because it does send my mind spinning for a second. You know, we have to be better than our creator gods. I think most of us go, what did he just say? You know, but then when you really break that down, hey, all this shit that we see around us that we think is so special, we know it can't be. That would be pulling us back into this materialism that says that this is all there is and this is what we must worship.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and as you might have picked up from that introduction, I have another episode of Skeptico at the Movies. And this time I've invited my friend Miguel Connor from the very excellent Aeon Byte Gnostic Radio to join me to explore a couple of Gnostically themed movies. You know, one of the things I really enjoy about Miguel's show and about Gnosticism in general is that it reminds me of when I was a kid and my parents would have a dinner party or have other adults over. And this didn't happen very often at my house, but when it did, I always felt the urge to sneak out of my room and carefully crawl around the corner and see if I could listen in on what the grown-ups were saying. And you can probably relate to this and remember what it was like as a kid, but you listen and on one hand, you can't really understand what's going on because they're talking about a lot of stuff that you haven't experienced and in a vocabulary in a way that you don't really understand. But on the other hand, you have a sense that there's some deeper knowledge there and there's some wisdom that you will grow into if you could only glean it. And that's often how I feel about Gnosticism and this Gnostic sensibility. I'm not exactly sure that I buy into a literal interpretation of what the Gnostics are telling us, but at the same time, I can't help but feel that the paradigm-shifting perspective that they bring offers us a new way of understanding the world around us. And obviously, I'm not alone, because Gnosticism keeps popping up again and again in our films, in our books, and in our culture in general. So what I thought we'd do in this show is pick out two examples of some very heavily themed Gnostic movies that you might have seen in the last few years. And I certainly had a great time talking with Miguel about these movies. I hope you enjoy our conversation about Snowpiercer and the Lego Movie. Today we welcome Miguel Connor to Skeptico for another round of Skeptico at the Movies. Miguel is the host of one of my favorite must-listen-to podcasts, Aeon Byte Gnostic Radio, where he explores all manner of topics related to Gnosticism, but in a broader sense, and this is the real hook for me, what happens when we dare ask the how-can-this-be question of all the strange stuff we run into in life. Miguel, welcome back. Thanks for joining me. This is going to be fun.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on, Alex. Love your work and love your heresy.
Cool. Yes, heresy. That's what it's all about.
Yes, it is.
So as I mentioned, you know, the last time I had you on, we talked about Gnosticism and we talked about your show, obviously, Aeon Byte. And You know, I kind of said that even though I'm not a card-carrying Gnostic or anything like that, I really feel a connection to your show because it opens up into a lot of other discussions related to that. And it's funny, when I thought about doing this show with you about Gnostic-themed movies, I was almost going to say, you know, let's try and do it without using the word Gnosticism, you know, just to make a point. The point being that, you know, this, if Gnosticism is at all true, we're enmeshed in it. So we don't really have to talk about it explicitly all the time, right? I mean, isn't that kind of the...
Oh, yeah, I would certainly agree. I mean, for example, we can talk about Gnostic themes in movies, and it's no secret gnosis that The Matrix is a modern Gnostic myth. But it's also no secret that The Matrix is likely our most powerful myth today. I mean, people still bring it up. They still call upon it. Many people believe it in different levels, even on your daily life. And so, therefore, there is definitely a connection between, the Gnostic world we live in today and not having to talk about Gnosticism.
Right. I mean, we can't get away from it. And even if we don't talk about The Matrix explicitly, I mean, it's kind of worked its way into, you know, whether you want to talk about the national security state or the military-industrial complex. I mean, at every turn... anyone who's familiar with Gnosticism would be, yeah, that's what we're talking about. That's what we're talking about.
Yeah, agreed. I think some figures like Tessa Dick and Michael Moorcock and others have said recently, we live in a Philip K. Dick world. This doesn't mean that all of Philip K. Dick's predictions came true. It simply means that finally the world or human consciousness is catching up with the Gnosticism of Philip K. Dick. The idea of being paranoid or feeling like an outcast or being really skeptic about everything is suddenly, you might say, not so much derided or ridiculed anymore. And people are waking up. And in a way, the Gnostics were saying the same thing that Philip K. Dick was saying. They weren't predicting anything. They're saying, hey, it's always been that way. It's time for the hologram of the empire, as Philip K. Dick called it, to come down, and we can see beyond the veil and see that humans, we've always been oppressed by powers and principalities of all sort. We've always lived in a false reality, and most of what we are is programmed. I like how you always talk about how we're just programmed robots without free will, and the Gnostics would probably agree, except for one part, the divine spark, as they called it, which in your show you would call the, you know, untainted consciousness, the power that allow us to really be, have empathy and creativity and to really be our own person. So, again, I would say that we do live in Gnostic times. We certainly live in a Philip K. Dick world.
Yeah, and I think that that will maybe unfold as we talk about these movies, because that's what I thought was really cool about our idea here, to just dig into popular culture, these movies that one of them, we're going to talk about Snowpiercer, is more explicitly dark and post-apocalyptic and, you know, has these heavy overtones. But it's really neat, I think, to contrast that with the other movie we selected, the Lego Movie, which presents itself as this kids animated movie that's just kind of fun, and they count down to the end of the earth by going 35 Mississippi, 34 Mississippi, you know, kind of thing. And I think that in there we can maybe give deeper meaning or a more clear meaning to what you're drawing on when you kind of, because I think it throws people when you say Philip K. Dick, and a lot of people don't even know who Philip, science fiction writer extraordinaire and philosopher, crazy psychedelic kind of guy Philip K. Dick is, let alone who the Gnostics and the early Christians were.
But if
you
bring up Minority Report or Blade Runner, everybody goes, oh, I can relate to that in this world.
Exactly. And I think that, you know, the other thing I think that people can relate to is this sense of, as they dig deeper, there's just the mystery and the darkness just gets more and more oppressive. You know, there's no way to look away from it. It's just like, oh my gosh, you know, that rock really is falling on my head in a way that I was just ignoring before. So cool.
Agreed, agreed. And this is a thought that came through. It was actually some listener emailed me, and maybe you have some of your own thoughts, that it seemed at the turn of the century, the Gnostic viewpoint was really exploding. You had The Matrix, you had The Truman Show, you had amazing, intense interest in The Da Vinci Code and Mary Magdalene, the Gospel of Mary Magdalene. Occult Gnostic groups were just sprouting everywhere. And then it seems we had two things. We had 9/11 and we had the rise of new atheism, which I don't think was an accident at all. I think it was probably orchestrated. And suddenly we kind of fell back into more, you might say, orthodox, materialistic, fundamentalist viewpoint. And hopefully with shows like yours and the added interest in the next few years, we're going back to that sort of awakening that we were having. What do you think, Alex?
Well, you know, that's kind of an interesting topic, and it's one that we've just kind of gotten into, because we could make the case that we're past that as well. So the new atheism wave kind of hit and has really kind of fallen back, you know. I mean, no one talks about Richard Dawkins seriously anymore like we did 6 or 7 years ago. And instead, we've kind of they've kind of done another switcheroo thing where they say, oh, well, yeah, of course, you know, we don't have to be mean to all these stupid religious people and these Islamic bombers and these Catholic fundamentalists. We don't have to be mean to those people because we've moved past that. You know, it's just let's all get along in a way that assumes that all that's bullshit and that we shouldn't pay any attention to the deeper sense of who we are. So, you know, that's one part of it in terms of the atheism part of it. In terms of the 9/11 thing, absolutely. I think that we are living in the script of post 9/11, you know, where we can just kind of take away people's rights willingly because they're giving it up because of the bigger danger that's out there. I think that's all over the place. But boy, that's a whole other topic to get into. What do you think is the fallout from 9/11 from your perspective, from the Gnostic perspective?
Well, I mean, I think that the lesson is as soon as there's an awakening, somebody's going to try to crush human consciousness immediately. Again, we talked about 9/11 and the repercussion of that, the rise of the surveillance state, which again, Philip K. Dick and the Gnostics said was always going on. And then you had, of course, new atheism. So the moral is they're going to come down hard on us. And it seems things are just going to get even crazier, especially with this presidential election. I think you will see a rise in mysticism, but as many scholars have shown, and you and I both have to be careful because we're not immune. But whenever there is great political upheaval, and scholars like Gary Lachman have noticed it, there is a sort of mysticism that begins crackling down on the streets. And it's a great thing. You know, people start experimenting, they start opening their eyes, they start having visions. But these things can easily lead to a sort of fascism and intolerance. I mean, what most people don't like to talk about in the occult is that mysticism is very tied into fascism, anti-Semitism, and other things. Again, power can make you crazy. So we just got to be careful if we're actually going through another awakening. I think the new modern myth, and you're starting to touch upon it, will probably have to be extraterrestrials or UFOs. And I think you'll also find very powerful Gnostic themes and stories in that. But that's the new myth that hopefully will be unfolding.
You know, that's the hard part, because I think you touched on a couple of things that are really important, and I don't know that I feel like I have a strong opinion on, but I vacillate wildly from one side to the other. And one is the relationship between the mystic extended consciousness experience and the co-opting of that experience on the other hand, like you're talking about. So, you know, we take a mystic and then we see what comes out of it and turns out to be turned right back against us, if you will. But I have to wonder if one is a consequence of the other, or if they are really, one is a perversion of the other. So is the mystical experience, is the extended consciousness experience pure per se, and is then being co-opted and used by the people in power? Or does it somehow in some way lead there, because in that extended consciousness realm, there's a lot of bad stuff too that can kind of pull us in that direction? Do you have any thoughts on that? I mean,
Well, I'm always going to take sort of the Gnostic extreme position, because it's always a good way to start, and you don't you keep your eyes open, you keep paranoid. But I would say that the mystic experience probably corrupts. I mean, one thing that the Gnostics have been blamed for, and completely wrong, is they talk about, if we can't go to God, then we will bring God down to us and we will become God. That's fine and dandy, but the problem is God on earth is always going to be a problem once you start dealing with material things. The Gnostic way was never that way, and right-wingers, all you see these posts all the time in their websites. The Gnostic view was always more like, we are going to go beyond the stars and connect with this otherness, and then we're going to come down and simply share our story and help others out. The Gnostics really saw themselves as Christian bodhisattvas. They really thought right. They had had an amazing experience with this otherworldly alien being, and they were going to sort of share that with full compassion and empathy. So I think that's the danger. I mean, again, we are human beings, and even some sort of divine power and awakening is going to be corrupted. I always like this saying. I don't know who said it, but he said, all movements start as an ideal, end up as a business, and then finish as a racket. And I think that's going to happen no matter what, as long as we're in the matrix. I know I'm using that word. As long as we're in the framework of this material world. I always like John Lennon's view, basically said when he joined a movement, he was going to just wait until it started rotting and he was just going to jump out. He never wanted to stick with something because he knew it would become a racket. And I think in the mystical occult movements, you have to be even more careful because you're dealing with some very powerful forces that can change things. Again, I would say people look at the work of Gary Lachman in his book, Politics on the Occult. It shows that this happens over and over again. Mystical occult movements not only corrupt people, but they change governments. But so I would say is always be very aware.
Yeah, although, you know, that kind of brings into question, like the bodhisattva kind of example, you know, the Buddha climbs the wall and but then comes back for the rest of us because realizes that liberation of one is kind of meaningless unless we're all liberated, basic idea. But by the same token, you know, I think one of your taglines or often repeated lines in your show is, you know, the spiritual awakening of a certain of any individual is
a cosmic event. Yeah, I'm quoting, I think, Edward Kanzi, the great Buddhist scholar.
Well, it's an awesome quote to be, you know, reminded of. So to me, it almost doesn't matter that it's going to be co-opted, it's going to be perverted, you know, in this material world, as you're kind of saying. I mean, so what? You know, we don't have to own that to a certain extent. But what I do feel like I'm compelled to kind of dig into is, you know, I just had an interesting chat with Brad Warner, who is this really cool guy. He's a Buddhist punk rock guy. So he used to be in a punk rock band.
And he's been on the show. Yeah.
He's been on your show. Brad. Great, great. So I like him, but then it's like, okay, Brad, what about reincarnation research, science, you know, done at University of Virginia and stuff like that? It's like, I don't know. Never looked at it, you know? So it's like, here's a guy who's formed an opinion that this atheistic, non-dual Buddhism, which is a complete Western invention, right? Mm-hmm, because right. Buddha, you know, it's like I always say to these guys, it's like Buddha never believed in atheism. Buddha was all about reincarnation and karma. If reincarnation and karma are the fundamental principles, you can't have those in a mind equals brain materialistic kind of world. You know, I also had Stephen Batchelor, the other atheist Buddhist on. And it's cool what they've done because they've opened up Buddhism to all these people in the West who are so, you know, traumatized by their Christian experience that they would never go there. Christian and Jewish experience, primarily here in the United States. But they're traumatized. They would never approach Buddhism, but they can once someone says, hey, this is really kind of atheistic, you know, in a lot of ways. But when you really get into it, it's not atheistic, you know, it's not atheistic at all in the sense that they're saying. So I guess my point is, well, despite the limitations of science and logic and reason, I feel like there's a certain grounding that we need to apply there in terms of trying to figure out this stuff, even if we have this idea going in that it's going to be impossible. Or if we put this Gnostic overlay on it, that, you know, it's impossible in this other way, that, you know, we're really screwed, you know, we're in the Matrix, we're really screwed. But what do you think about that? Can we still navigate this terrain better with reason, logic, science? Or is that just going to be another trick, deception tool for us? Do you know where I'm coming from on that?
Yeah, I would say we can. I mean, I always try. I'm not a trained scholar, and much of my science is reading your books, the works of Anthony Peake, and others when it comes to the esoterica, you know, near-death experiences and all that. But I would say that, yes, I mean, we have to be grounded on reason. I mean, the classic Gnostics were philosophers. They knew all the Hellenistic education and so forth. So, but again, it's all a matter of just being attentive. I mean, I come from more of a philosophical Gnostic view. That's how I apply it to it. And at the end of the day, I know that all religion is basically art. It's a form of art. And the best gift we can as human beings, regardless of the situation or the science or anything else, is to create better than the creator gods, to create better than those that suppress us. That, I think, is our ultimate divinity, to be able to create, to be able to invent. So when I take that attitude and I keep myself honest about it, things will work out. Like you said, maybe things will go wrong with the movement, but maybe there'll be some great creation, some great idea that will help others in that sort of bodhisattva attitude.
Yeah, that's really kind of cool. And I love that Gnostic kind of twist that you always add in, because it does send my mind spinning for a second in a way that's really cool, because it settles back down. So like you say, you know, we have to be better than our creator gods. And I think most of us go, what did he just say? You know, but then when you really break that down in terms of what that means, it's like, hey, all this shit that we see around us that we think is so special, we know is it, by definition, almost from a mystical standpoint, it can't be. It pulls us back. That would be pulling us back into this materialism that says this is all it's it. This is all there is, and this is what we must worship, and this is what we must put to the highest level, right? I mean, isn't that really where you're going with that?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, again, I come from a philosophical, artistic bent. I like to feel that hopefully I'm in the same current as William Blake and Philip K. Dick and Carl Jung and all those whose great contribution is simply powerful art, the ultimate expression of our human souls to really break away the veil. And again, everything else hopefully takes care of itself. I don't just mean art, but invention. Every human being has the capacity of making something truly wonderful and life-changing. And something that will inevitably piss off the elite, the archons, the gods of this world.
And the religious orthodoxy that we know. Because I think what's offensive or kind of jarring about that statement is when we say creation, we're immediately put back into the pews of the church where we grew up, or the synagogue or the temple or whatever, where we heard that, you know, God created everything and we're just these little peons. And you're switching that around and you're saying, no, you're creating everything every minute. And if you limit that, then you're limiting your ability to be a creator God.
Right. We were cast down in this world through no fault of our own. We're stuck here. So the best we can do is to create something wonderful. And to help somebody else. The Gnostics were Christians, so of course they certainly believed in simple compassion, empathy, and doing something nice for somebody.
Yeah. And as long as we're just kind of having this freewheeling discussion here for a minute, you know, I was just listening to one of your shows recently, and it was an older show because for whatever reason, the way your podcasts come up through my podcatcher, I sometimes get these really old shows back when you were doing Coffee, Cigarettes, and Doses. Right. But it was great because it was really like a primer for me, and it kind of filled me in on stuff. And it was on Philip K. Dick, you know. And the part that I thought was just blew me away was Philip K. Dick's exegesis on the infinite, you know, and that no matter which, if you try and approach anything, anything from a logical or reason-based standpoint, there is an infinite spawning of questions, of regressions, of impossible to answer kind of paths that lead you to the point that, you know, I really am just kind of creating all this foundation that isn't really built on anything. Do you remember what I'm talking about?
Yes, that's Philip K. Dick's argument with God. I don't know if it's in the exegesis, but because you could find it before the book came out. Yes, and he starts trying to outwit God in this long argument, and there's an infinite number of synthesis and counter-synthesis and so forth. And he's using basically sort of a Hegelian dialect, and he's always going to lose. And it always brings me back to what was William James famously said, God knows everything, but therefore he can't know what is unknown, and God can do everything, so he can't do what is impossible. He can only do what is possible. In there is sort of the Gnostic trick to defeating God, and it's the idea that, yes, you are going to lose, but there is that small little crack you can get through into the unknown, and that's how you win.
Yeah, that's really cool. And I feel like I've kind of personally experienced some of that in doing Skeptico, you know, in that you go kind of earnestly and naively into these topics. I should say I do. You know, I go earnestly and naively into these topics, and then I get this point counterpoint that leads to these infinite number of trails to follow. And at some point you go, wait a minute, what am I doing? You know, I am really at the center of this. I am creating this in a way that I don't fully understand. So I think that's really cool.
Yeah. It seems to be a smart way to go if you can retain some semblance of sanity through it all. And Philip K. Dick definitely struggled with it, most of it throughout all of his life, but he definitely came towards the end of his life to great moments of peace and serenity. So it can be done, but it's not an easy journey.
Cool. Okay, so Miguel, what I thought we should do then is dive into a couple of really cool movies that might help us make some of these points come to light in a new way. So which one should we tackle first, the Lego Movie or Snowpiercer?
Why don't we go with Snowpiercer?
Snowpiercer. Excellent. Okay. I love this one. And you played one of the clips from this before I even had seen the movie. You played a clip from this on Aeon Byte. And that's what kind of drew me to the movie. Actually, I went and Googled that clip, the words from it, and found the movie and then had to watch it. So this is a 2013 post-apocalyptic fantasy thriller starring Chris Evans, Ed Harris, and a bunch of other people you've either never heard of or barely recognized. And while the premise of the movie I thought is really kind of silly, that all of humanity's last survivors are on this train that's spinning, that's driving around the world, you know, kind of a silly kind of thing, it does lead to some absolutely terrific moments in the film and great scenes. Like this one that I thought I'd play for people to kind of introduce it, where Mason is giving this speech to those riding in the back of the train, and we all know what it means to ride in the back of the train. So hey, can I go ahead and play this clip?
Sure, let's hear it.
This is not a shoe. This is disorder. This is size 10 chaos. This is death. In this locomotive we call home, there is one thing that between our warm hearts and the bitter cold, Clothing? Shields? No. Order. Order is the barrier that holds back the frozen death. We must, all of us, on this train of life, remain in our allotted station. We must, each of us, occupy our preordained particular position. Would you wear a shoe on your head? Of course you wouldn't wear a shoe on your head. A shoe doesn't belong on your head. A shoe belongs on your foot. A hat belongs on your head. I am a hat. You are a shoe. I belong on the head. You belong on the foot. Yes? So it is.
Okay. So, Miguel, you want to tell us a little bit about what's going on in that scene?
That's very interesting. And it's also, actually, Alex, full of synchronicity. That's when Minister Mason is lecturing those at the back of the train and played by the wonderful Tilda Swinton. And she appears like sort of an Ayn Rand-esque type of figure. And she's lecturing, but her name Mason struck me interesting because, as other pointed, was she talking? Is she a Freemason, a builder? Aren't the Freemasons the good guy? Then I recently had put up an old interview by Acharya S., rest her soul. And I remember she has in her book Sons of God, 60 pages fully detailed with heavy scholarship on how these builders and Freemasons actually have been going back since the beginning of time, and they're not exactly a benign brotherhood. And she doesn't talk about an unbroken lineage, but that their ideas and their skills have been passed down. And so that's what struck me very interesting about Minister Mason. So of course the movie is about the oppression. I know the original graphic novel has to do more with the class warfare and class inequality, but the movie definitely takes a very powerful Gnostic take, because those in the back of the train are those that are oppressed, and you could say they're the ones that are in Plato's cave, and they try to go through. They create a revolution, a revolt, and they start breaking through the different cabooses, and with each caboose, they see more of a better world, even though it's still false, but they do find more truths about this system, this creation, because all of humanity is living on the train. And this, of course, harkens back to the Gnostic idea of trying to break through the different heavens through flights of the soul and fighting these supreme beings, which they call the archons, or sometimes angels, the powers and principalities. And that's what this movie does. You have the main character, Curtis, going up through the train until, of course, they get to the head of the train. And who's there? Well, in the Gnostic myth, it would be the Demiurge, that sort of mechanistic god who creates this, mechanistic universe that is very flawed and always on the verge of just breaking down. And, of course, it's very interesting because Ed Harris plays the Demiurge. He's called Wilford, the original creator of the train that goes around the world forever with humanity. And, of course, as many of you know, Wilford did play the Demiurge figure in that other very powerful Gnostic movie, The Truman Show. So when I saw Ed Harris, for some reason I knew this was going to be a Gnostic myth even before I saw the movie. Right. So it has a lot of very powerful Gnostic themes.
Oh, it definitely does for anyone who knows Gnosticism. Here's what I think is interesting. What do you hear from folks who are not into Gnosticism when they see the film? Have you had a chance to talk to anyone, or what is your sense for how people react to the film without this Gnostic sensibility? Because that's what I think is really back to the theme that we set early on here, you know, without even using the word Gnosticism, why does this film resonate so strongly with folks?
Well, again, I think it does. They probably do take it as some sort of class warfare, class inequality kind of movie. They don't see the different themes going on. And there are a lot of probably other deeper Christian themes, like that scene when the bad guys grab a fish and they gut it in front of the poor oppressed people. That's definitely a Jesus motif. There's one scene where Chris Evans puts a hand over his face and he has a bullet hole on his hand. And of course, there we have another Jesus motif. And sometimes these motifs do overlap because, after all, the Gnostics were Christians. They saw Jesus as a great exemplar, or at least a great character in a myth they were trying to follow. So they do overlap. I mean, just recently, I always talk about how I think Fight Club is a great Gnostic myth. And I had a discussion with a Baptist minister at this conference, and he told me, no, I see the Christian themes in Fight Club. Well, I say, well, they do overlap, that's for sure.
Right, right. You know, and I agree with you in one sense, and that I think the class conflict thing is obvious, right? So this is the Occupy movement that we all kind of see and can outwardly kind of identify with. But as you mentioned, what I thought was really terrific about the film is as they move through the various cars, so they start in the back and they're battling their way through. And it does take you immediately into this kind of trippy fantasy, but also mystical kind of thing to really understand and grok what these different cars are. And I think people get that. I think people get that in a way that is beyond a USA Today or CNN report of, you know, what's going on in the world. And what do you think about the connection that we're all making in terms of these deeper mystical themes? Because hell, you look at just not only this movie, but you look at the top 100 movies. I mean, it's all over the place. It, obviously, people are connecting with this, but again, it's kind of strange that we don't talk about it explicitly. Instead, we talk about it, like you said, we talk about, oh, it's class warfare. It's the rich against the poor. You know, it's that, but it's so much more than that.
Yeah, well, people just, they're not in tune with their archetypes, with the symbolisms, with the collective unconscious, as ancient man used to be. So it's a lot harder to see that. I mean, the movie obviously has to be more than that, because in a class warfare or whatever kind of movie, at the end, Chris Evans and his band of misfits, they fight their way up, and Chris Evans, of course, meets the man behind the curtain, Wilford, played by Ed Harris. The Demiurge, the god of this world. Now, in obviously a nice little class warfare film, you know, they would just take over and everybody lives happily on the train or whatever. But this one takes a decisively Gnostic slant because Wilford says, I can make you God. Remember, we were talking about that theme, bringing God down to you. He says, I will make you the god of this train. In essence, that's what he tells him. And Chris Evans has a choice. He can be the god, or he can reject the god of this universe. And I don't want to say any spoilers unless you feel that's okay.
Spoil it.
Yeah, it came out in 2013. What the heck, right? If you haven't streamed it yet. So Chris Evans, as the Christ figure, by then he is the Christ figure. He has the holes in his hands. He has redemptive qualities. He's realize that he's repented because he has eaten other human beings when he was starved, which goes to a very Gnostic theme. The Gnostics had a huge aversion to any sort of sacrificial atonement kind of thing. They rejected that. But in any event, Chris Evans or Curtis simply says, no, I don't want this world. I don't want any part of this world because it is a construct. A construct, sorry. So at the end, the train is destroyed, and we have the best that can come out of it is, of course, a new start, a new cycle where you have two children, a male and a female, survive and leave the train in a world that is no longer, that seems to be going up in temperature.
Right, right. So from a Gnostic standpoint, what is that ray of hope at the end? What is that jumping off the train as opposed to staying on the train? How do you...
Well, the ray of hope is that you've awakened. You can't control what's going to happen. The universe is going to crush you, whether you get old or you try a movement and you end up executed or put on a cross. It's the awakening that liberates you and sends you and, well, assists you in transcending this world. And for the world, but the best you can do is what happens. Everything falls apart. And you get another chance. You get the new Adam and Eve, And these two kids are enlightened because they've seen the horrors of the train. So again, as you said, the awakening itself is the cosmic event. That in itself should be enough, you would think, right? You know, we don't need clubs and cards and nice cars after that.
Right, right. And as a matter of fact, that's kind of well established in a variety of kind of mystical traditions, and in the yogic tradition, you know, one way, and other traditions as well, one way to get there is kind of this fake it until you make it kind of asceticism, where you don't take part in the material world, but the Gnostic at all, you know, so try and rid yourself of all your possessions, rid yourself of everything, so you're not, so you can kind of see those two worlds more clearly. But that is a decidedly different approach than the Gnostic approach, isn't it? I mean, what do you make of the battle that Curtis is making? I mean, Gnosticism is about engaging in that battle in a way that other mystical traditions, religious traditions, are not. Would that be fair?
Yeah, that's philosophically, that certainly seems to be the way. I mean, remember, Curtis's ultimate liberation is not to free the people from the train, or to defeat Wilford, Ed Harris. It's to find his own soul liberation. That's what gets him out of it. I mean, there's, what's that saying when you were talking, it reminded me of in Buddhism. Before I was enlightened, I chopped wood and gathered water. After right. I'm enlightened, I gathered wood and chopped water. The Gnostics, they weren't exactly world-rejecting. That's a little bit overstated. But they were certainly productive members of society. But once inside, once awakened, then it was time to awaken others. And that in itself was the great cosmic event. Again, we go back to the Christian Bodhisattva kind of attitude.
Right. But the Gnostics would identify with plowing through those trains and wreaking havoc in order to get what you want in a way that I think, let's say, Buddhists probably would not, right?
Right. I mean, the Gnostics saw a lot of great inspiration in the story of St. Paul, who he was plowing through his own torments and killing Christians and doing his thing. And he finally saw the light. He had his moment of gnosis. He still had to go to Saudi, or he went to Arabia for 3 years. Oh, no, I can't just escape reality. I got to go come back and start spreading that gnosis. So there are, there's certainly levels of growth as you go from a more of a body type of attitude to a mental type of attitude. And ultimately you go to the third level, which is the spiritual awakened kind of attitude. So, yeah, the Gnostics certainly, as I've mentioned, drew some heavy lines in the sand. They were sort of the punk rockers, geeks of those times. They were not going to compromise. And they were going to fight, but it had the paradox that they were full of compassion and full of love for everything.
Great. So is there anything else about Snowpiercer we need to add in?
Let me think. There are a few. I did mention the part about how the blood atonement and sacrifice, the cannibalism that other religions have, they certainly rejected it. But at the moment, no, we can move to the next movie.
You know, and I don't want to digress too far, but I think the cannibalism angle is extremely interesting because there is some evidence for cannibalism or related to, you know, the working with the blood of deceased bodies or growing hallucinogenic mushrooms on these bodies. I mean, so there is that strain that we can find some evidence for in early Christian and in pre-Christian activities that kind of overshadows this in maybe some way. Do you see any kind of connection there, or are we stretching too far on that one?
No, there's a connection there, and I think the Gnostic attitude was to completely reject it. I mean, we do know by looking at the Old Testament and history that human sacrifice was even prevalent in ancient Judaism.
Exactly.
There's a lot of polemics about what Christians did, and we do know from old occultism that people were using the head of children or the head of some saint to cast spells and to gain divination. So this sort of necromancy has been going on for a long time, and I guess the Gnostic attitude was like, no, why don't you read a book instead? Or why don't you pray? The way out is way out. You don't need all these things, especially if somebody's going to get hurt over it.
Great, great. Okay, so let's talk about this other movie that we selected to kind of pull out some of these themes and talk about them, and that is The Lego Movie, a 2014 animated kids movie with some really, really big name stars, Chris Pratt, Will Ferrell, Morgan Freeman, and all these big stars. They got together and made this hugely successful movie. It grossed like $500 million. And as I mentioned early on, it has these kind of quirky, very kidsy kind of things, but the themes in it are completely, completely Matrix Gnostic, directly in that way. Do you want to kind of give us an overall synopsis of the movie, or your thoughts about it from a Gnostic perspective?
Yeah, I hope people have seen it. Again, we have you have two worlds, and that's a very powerful Gnostic theme, the two-world paradigm. There's always a false world and a real world. And sometimes you don't know which is which. That's another thing. Even in the Matrix, some people say that Neo still is in the Matrix, even at the end of the movie. That's one of the fan theories.
Let's add in, Miguel, that from the very beginning, Lego is another world, right? So, and as we find at the end of the movie, this is a world inside of the head or the fantasy of the child. So then once we get in there, then that's another example of this kind of two-world thing playing out, right? And Lego.
Exactly. And remember, the father, who turns out to be then sort of the demiurge figure in the imaginary world, he wants everything orderly, everything by the numbers, everything perfect as it's supposed to be. And the hero, what is his name? I already forgot.
Emmett.
He is the expression of the child, that Gnostic expression, like, no, I just want to create. I want to create how I was intended to craft my own worlds instead of the worlds that have been placed to me, the worlds that are instruction manuals and so forth.
I want to do Legos.
The way I want to. Yeah, I want to create better than the creator gods. And that's the big battle there. And in this one, the father, Will Ferrell, who plays the bad guy, and the father figure in the real world, he comes to sort of a repentance, and he realizes that, yeah, that's the way to go. And that's nothing strange. In some Gnostic themes, God himself repents and says, all right, humans, you've just taught me that there is something better beyond me and around me, and I'm just going to let you guys do your own way. So the Lego movie is extremely Gnostic, but as you mentioned, people will confuse it because when it came out, again, all these people, well, it's an anti-capitalist movie and all this, that, and you could say, well, yes, it is, but it really is a movie about oppression and waking up, whether we live in a capitalist society, whether we lived in a communist society, medieval society, the themes of oppression and waking up to your true creative self are always going to be the same. It just happens today that we do live in a capitalistic society. It's probably as synthetic and false as all others, and it probably does suppress the innate creativity of most people. But it just happens. But it's not solely an anti-capitalistic movie. It probably really isn't one at all.
Not when it makes $500 million, it's not.
Again, yes, damned if you do, damned if you don't while you're in this world.
Right. Let's play a clip from that movie where Emmett, as you said, who is the hero, is confronting, I don't know, Morgan Freeman, what would you say? He is his kind of... is God, he's the Yoda kind of figure.
He's the Morpheus. He's what they call the Gnostic revealer. Before you wake up to your own Christ-like self, there is always a voice or a messenger that comes and nudges you, like Morpheus, and say, hey, you got two choices. Take the blue pill or the red pill. So yeah, he's a Morpheus character, the Gnostic revealer.
And who better for that than Morgan Freeman, right?
Yeah, who played God himself in another movie.
Here we go.
The reason I made up the prophecy was because I knew that whoever found the peace could become the special. Because the only thing anyone needs to be special is to believe that you can be. I know that sounds like a cat poster, but it's true. Look at what you did when you believed you were special. You just need to believe it some more.
But how can I just decide to believe that I'm special? I'm not.
Because the world depends on it.
Zavid, termination. In 35. Mrs.
What?
34.
I love them when they count down Mississippi. The other really cute thing about the movie, and you do have to say it's cute because that's what they're going for there, but when they say, I know that sounds like something from a cat poster, you know, so that'll give people a sense for how they're really playing with these ideas that can become really kind of heavy, because let's face it, a lot of these post-apocalyptic movies do have a real darkness to them, and that's what Snowpiercer does. In this movie, it doesn't. So do you think they're trying to say anything with that?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, one of the themes, and again, this is something that I've discussed or read the work of Gary Lachman on hermeticism and the work of Eric Wilson. And both of these scholars say that, yes, the Gnostics did play with a lot of existentialism. And they almost toyed with nihilism. It's sort of, you know, that you're looking into the abyss is a moment of gnosis. There is nothing there, and there is no meaning. But by this simple action, you have one choice, which is basically to give meaning to this universe and to find that little spark of divinity within you, that little spark of creativity, and going again to the theme, to create better than the creator gods, as a kid wanted to do versus his oppressive father. And I think that's what the Lego movie does, because it seems that Emmett, everything he's done is meaningless, but what he has done in essence is give meaning to a very cold and oppressive and mechanistic world. So I think that's the thing we get there, even if it has to do with cats and other little sort of trite modern memes.
You know, and I love what you just touched on there about the playfulness, because I've never thought about it quite that way. But there is a certain playfulness in the Gnostic sensibility. It's like heavy, dark, and then it's like wink. Ah, but it's all just a game anyway, you know. Where does that fit in Gnostic philosophy? Yeah,
as some scholars have pointed out, the Gnostics very much played with parody long before it was sort of a literary device. They sort of made fun of the God of this world, usually associated with Jehovah of the Old Testament. They loved turning ideas upside down. And they liked, yeah, it's almost like they had a little chuckle. I mean, the difference, which I always point out, is if you look at the canonical gospels, Jesus is always very serious. I don't think he smiles. He certainly doesn't laugh. When you start reading the Gnostic gospels, he's laughing all the time, usually kind of making fun of somebody for being so foolish or not awakened or not seeing the truth in front of them or making fun of society and the universe in general. So for reasons that we really don't know of, because so much has been eradicated, they certainly had a sort of playfulness about it. I mean, I think you have to. I mean, humor is what keeps us sober when we find out the truth of our lives, often. I mean, comics are some of the most serious people in the world.
That's the reason why humor is there, is because how can it not be there in the situation that we find ourselves in? It is this kind of tragic black comedy that we find ourselves in. And I also like the link between, you know, again, so many of these Gnostic ideas, when they're taken literally, have a jarring effect on us. You know, when we think Jehovah is this false god that's kind of like, back to our Snowpiercer example, is barely keeping this train going by, you know, adjusting these weird nuts and bolts. But on another level, I like connecting that, like we were talking about earlier, with some of the quote-unquote reason-based, logic-based tools like archaeology and scholarship, where when we really look back and look at Jehovah and look at the traces of that we have, here's Thunder God, you know? Here's Thunder God out of the sky. So when you want to get all pious and say, oh my gosh, don't talk about the God of the Bible in that way, you step back and go, wait a minute, do you know who the God of the Bible really was?
Yeah, he was a tribal god. And somehow he started, he got mixed in with the philosopher gods of Plato and so forth. And it, we kind of got ourselves a very schizophrenic deity. And of course, as there is a Gnostic text, the Gospel of Philip basically says, we create our gods and it's better if the gods worshiped us. Somehow our gods end up like us and we end up like them. And that's
right.
As you've seen in your show, that's a big issue. We need better right. gods. We need better stories, better myths. Was it recently I had Jeff Kripal, who wrote Supernatural with Whitley Strieber. And Whitley Strieber basically said something very interesting. And Jeff Kripal said it's very Gnostic. He said the reason aliens appear to us with the big eyes and sort of not very advanced flying saucers is because our movies are that way. Even though when you look at Alien Encounters, that's not what they appeared to a lot of these people. He said, if we make better sci-fi movies, these extraterrestrials will start showing up more advanced and more benign to us. And I think that's interesting how we co-create this world, at least the images of this world.
You know, that's an interesting point, and not to digress too far, I love Jeff Kripal, and he's been on the show a couple times. I think he's just top notch. Talk about a breath of fresh air in academia. You know, there you have it. By the same token, I'm not willing to go too far there, because if we're going to play, and again, this is back to the Gnostic thing, you know, if we're going to play this consensus reality game, and to me that means we can measure things, we can say things like what you just said, because it's layered, right? We can say things like, gosh, those flying saucers don't really move that fast. Okay, even that is a judgment about that we can measure things in a certain way. So if we're going to play that game, then I think we're also bound by a broader look at that, you know, because no, that it really doesn't fit into the we're creating the fantasy and we need better sci-fi to create better. We have real people who've had real experiences with these beings, and in the best way we can measure them. I mean, if you want to take the Travis Walton example, where he gets abducted with five of his buddies, and five of his buddies ride into town and they're ready to be arrested because they're all telling the same story. No, the guy was taken up in a spaceship. Well, we have no way of explaining how everyone could see the same thing. So unless we want to jump into this whole other alternative reality that, again, moves us away from our consensus reality, so then we can't say anything about anything, you know? If we're going to jump over there and say, well, it's all, you know, just being created, then we like I said, we can't say anything about anything. So
yeah.
I don't know.
You should follow – no, of course you should follow the data. You got to follow the science. It's going to take you to some wonderful places, but it's a little bit more nuanced. I mean, what's the example? The original guy, and I can't remember his name, saw the flying saucers, Kenneth Arnold, and I believe he said that there were these circles, these rounds, but he said that they were living things. And of course, I've done ghost investigations. I know that when these sort of entities appear, circles or flat spheres is normal. The problem is that the press, when they got a hold of it, misrepresented it, and suddenly we had these machines that were flying around. And of course, this might have affected other people down the road who already had this sort of data in their head about what extraterrestrials would look. Suddenly we have flying saucers instead of these beings, and suddenly these are made into movies which are affecting other people. So I think what Jeff is talking about, or even the Gnostic way, is we need to sort of take a breather and sort of stop, maybe even reboot things, but the data's there, it's sound, and sort of start seeing things in a new way.
Yeah, fair enough. And I wonder, though, you know, contrasting that with trying to pull it back to the movie, the Lego movie, one seems very materialistic, even when it's trying not to be materialistic. And I guess that's my point with Jeff Kripal, again, who's fantastic, right? But it's a meta-materialistic explanation, right? So it's like, oh, that's silly materialism brought on by movies that are materialistic in a way, you know what I mean? And what I think is liberating about the Gnosticism that, like we see in the Lego movie, is it transcends all that and says, wait a minute, back to the great broadcast you did on Philip K. Dick and the infinite regress, right? So it's like we were talking about with the Lego movie. It's this Lego that's caught in these two worlds. But Lego is in a world, and it's in the mind of a boy, and it's a father. And you keep going back and regress infinitely until at some point you go, well, the heck with it. You know, it's I am the only thing that is, you know, so I'm creating all this reality. And my alarm bells always go off when we use one materialistic explanation to try and overcome materialism, you know.
Mm-hmm. No, I would certainly agree with you, and I think that's what I've been talking about. It. We have to be careful with all these things. It's not all. It is all inside of our head, but at the same time, the universe is inside of our head, and we are within the universe. And there's a lot of people inside this universe. I don't know if that makes sense, but it's pretty nuanced. And I know I might be abusing the word nuance, but I like the word nuance.
I think that's perfect. So, what else do we want to say about the Lego movie, and in particular, the kind of hero's journey to borrow a term from Joseph Campbell. I mean, what do you think about the hero's journey in Gnosticism?
Well, they changed it a bit. It wasn't exactly the hero's journey. It was, and I know Joseph Campbell talks about the soul's high adventure. And this goes back to Plato. There's very little the Gnostics did that wasn't based on Plato. They just put their own sort of punk rock, nasty edge to it. But is that the soul? Somehow we were in a state of awakening, or part of us, and we've fallen asleep, fallen into matter, and now it's the journey upwards. And, of course, in the Lego movie, he is going through all these lands, all these different states. He's meeting all the great archetypes of our society, C-3PO, Batman, and all of the great images of our childhood, which appear in the form of Legos. And again, he is sort of awakening. I mean, the story is about the son falling asleep and falling into this world as something else, into a new identity, and having to awaken to his true nature, very much like Neo.
I thought it was a cool movie. I took my youngest daughter to see it, and it was kind of perfect age for her. And she kind of got it at one level, and I was sitting there going, wow, this is so cool. This is such a good movie. So
yeah, I saw it. It was actually not too after my father died. So I found myself choked up because in a way I saw the idea of that, hey, maybe, you know, just like the Demiurge or Jehovah, he was just following his nature. I had issues with my dad, and I realized, you know, he was just following his issue. He was following his programming. He had his issues. But at the end of the day, it's a matter of having compassion, even for the ultimate, even for the God of this world. So to me, it really was a very touching and cathartic movie. But that's where I was at the time, and I don't feel it was a synchronicity. It was just time for me to feel these emotions.
Yeah. Well, this has been so cool, and I think we've given people, hopefully, we've given folks a whole new way to look at a couple films, and it's going to be even great if you haven't seen these movies, or if you have, I guess either way, but to go back and revisit them and see if you agree with us and see these same themes, or if maybe we're just totally going out in the stratosphere without connection to reality. So
well,
this has been really cool.
Two guys from Chicago talking often don't make sense. So hopefully the exception, you know, rarely does anything esoteric or insightful come down when two guys from Chicago get together. We'll break fate.
That's right. I mean, it's, as you just said, I'm taking it all with a grain of salt here, a big grain of salt. So Miguel, before we let you go, tell folks what else is going on with you and what's going on at Aeon Byte.
Well, the show must go on, and it continues. I think I'm actually reaching my 10th year. I can't believe it, but it's still going on every week at thegodabovegod.com. Please go there. Please support it any way you can, and certainly support Alex, because we of the alternative media, we're the guys trying to get to the front of the caboose. We're the guys trying to waken up. We're not owned by a few corporations. So give us all some love. And as far as what's coming out, I think I'm working on the second book for Voices of Gnosticism. And if everything goes well, it should be out by Christmas time.
Great. Well, that's something to look forward to. And that's a great way, I think, for people to kind of jumpstart their way into the material, because one thing I have to say about Miguel's show, and do, if you haven't, visit it and dip your toe into it, is that it's extremely well done, extremely well produced, and it is kind of cinematic in an audio way, and it kind of takes you on this great journey that I think is, I haven't heard anything like it, and it's great to listen to every week. So I look forward to it. 10 years, awesome. 10 more.
Thanks.
Love to see it. Well, it's been great having you on again, Miguel, and thanks so much for joining me.
I love talking to you, Alex, and thank you for having me on.
Thanks again to Miguel O'Connor for joining me today on Skeptico. One question to tee up from this interview: why are these Gnostically themed movies so popular? What are they tapping into both in us and our culture? What do we need to listen to and know about the message they're sending us? Miguel and I obviously shared some thoughts on that, but I'd love to hear what you think. The place to do it is through the Skeptico website at skeptiko.com. You can join our very excellent forum and join other listeners and talk over there, or just leave a comment or send me a Facebook message or an email, whatever you choose. I'd love to hear from people. I'd love to hear your comments. I'd love to hear what you think your favorite Gnostically themed movie or book is. That would be fun to hear as well. Of course, while you're at the website, subscribe to the show, iTunes, Stitcher, or any other way you have of doing it, or just download and listen to any of the 300 previous shows, all available there for free. One more thing, of course, while you're there, if you can, share your favorite episodes. Just hit the old share button there on Facebook, or hit the share button on Twitter, or hit the share button and send someone an email. I love when people share the show with other people. That's how we get new listeners, and it's always fun to hear from new people who've just discovered the show and say, oh, wow, I didn't know it was out there, and now I'm listening to all these old shows, and I really like this one. So if you can help me make that happen, I sure appreciate it. That's one of the great pleasures for me in doing the show, is introducing this material to people who haven't heard it. So if you can be part of that process, that would be great. I do have a number of interesting, at least I think they're interesting, shows coming up. And I have some even more interesting ones booked for the future. Keep sending your suggestions for who you'd like to hear. Do be aware that I might push you a little bit to go and help me book that person on. I love to pull people in and helping me be a part of the show in that way. It's fun for me, and hopefully it's fun for you. So know if you suggest someone, I'm likely to email you back and say, great, why don't you invite them on and see if they'll come, and then I'll take it from there. But of course, you don't have to do that. If you have a suggestion, just send it. But if you're willing to take that extra step, you're much more likely to hear the guest you want on Skeptico. Okay, that'll do it for this episode. Thanks again so much for joining me. Take care, and bye for now.